Welcome to episode 3 of the In Our House Now podcast, an inquiry into Twin Peaks The Return. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Minton, and the other host is John Thorne, who's joining me. How are you, John?
I'm doing great, Josh. It is always great to talk to you about Twin Peaks.
I agree. What is our theme for this week?
Well, I thought we would take a little bit of a change of pace and look at the more forensic idea of politics in Twin Peaks. So I have a couple of quotes I thought would be good to start with. And I'll just say that I think that the political element of Twin Peaks is sometimes overlooked. It isn't perhaps as overt as some of the other themes that are in the show, but I think it's really a crucial topic to talk about because I think the political and socioeconomic events of the United States and the world were a big motivator for Mark Frost to want to return to the world of Twin Peaks. And he wanted to incorporate some of those ideas into the show. And I think early on, that was a factor. So we could make an argument that political and economic and social issues of the day were really one of the core elements that allowed for this new Twin Peaks to come back. And so if you look in Conversations with Mark Frost, a great book by David Bushman, Bushman asks Frost about the 2008 financial collapse. And he says, Mark Frost says, "We started writing in the aftermath of the collapse so that housing project in Vegas was a stand-in for the abandoned ghost town neighborhoods of late stage capitalism that popped up everywhere. And what that was doing to people, how this was hollowing out small towns. So that was anticipatory. The crash may have started in 2009, but it's pretty important background music that brought us to the Trump era." And so I think that's really important to keep in mind as we talk about Twin Peaks. But slightly contrasting that idea is something David Lynch said in Lynch on Lynch when he was also asked about politics and politics and art. And Lynch says, "If you're politically motivated or a thinking person, you'll see everything that comes out in terms of politics. Likewise, if you're a very religious person, you'll see everything that comes out in terms of religion or religious things. So you have to concentrate on your work and put it out. I think politics are at one level. And if you don't go above that level, you're going to be stymied and frustrated." And I think what he's trying to get at there is that politics can be a crucial element of the art and something that he, Lynch, may want to incorporate, but he doesn't want to stay entirely focused on that. And I don't think Frost did either. I think perhaps, though, politics was a bit more of a driving force for Frost than it might have been for Lynch. So with those two quotes in mind, I thought we would just jump in and see what kind of political strands and themes we see in Twin Peaks The Return.
Yeah, this is great. And I actually had one element that I'd like to add as you were talking. It made me think that it might be worth bringing up James Joyce here. You and I have kind of talked about Joyce in the past, but he had a theory that he put out in The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where Stephen Dedalus finally comes to this point of his artistic growth where he has his own philosophy about art. And it's a really poignant one that I think is going to help us in this conversation. And basically, he said that art is of two orders, proper and improper. And he said that improper art was built to move you one way or another. So he called one of the forms pornography, which is designed to draw you towards it, whatever it is that you're looking at or seeing or reading. It's designed to pull you in so that you just seek to possess whatever that is that's represented, not just sexual, but you know, it could be anything, money, whatever. And the other form is didactic. So it pushes you away. And with this, I think, like, you know, Rage Against the Machine or Nine Inch Nails or, you know, something on the line, Saturday Night Live, something that's designed to present reality in a way to you that causes you to move away from it, either in fear or loathing. And then he talked about proper art as the kind that holds you in aesthetic arrest, that kind of pierces the moment, so that you rise above yourself and your history and your experience, and you kind of feel this oneness, very similar to what, you know, the common ground in transcendental meditation and the unified field, you know, that concept of art as being that engine. And so I think as we talk about politics, I want to also talk about which side of proper and improper, and what kind of improper art it is. So let's talk about Frost first. I think that's probably the easiest.
Yeah, and I think it's essential to talk about Frost. Obviously he's the co-creator, so of course it is. But we often talk more about Lynch. He was essentially the last filter through which this material passed, and so obviously he gets a little bit more authorial credit for that. But those foundations, so much of what's in the original show and the new show are from Frost. I mentioned it, you know, from the quote, that Frost was interested in what was happening in the United States and the crash of 2008, and he wanted to address those themes. And so we start to see some of those themes very early on. Obviously, the quote itself references it, but the abandoned houses in Las Vegas, where Dougie appears, the idea that there are all these homes that were built in hopes that they would be, you know, sold and new neighborhoods would pop up, and they've become essentially ghost towns. And so Frost wanted to address that idea, and you get a little bit of that through Janie E as well. When Janie E talks about being part of the 99%, that's an interesting phrase, the 99%, because that's a relatively new politically charged idea that's only of this century. You wouldn't have heard the 99% in the original Twin Peaks. And that comes from that era of the crash and the end of the Bush and beginning of the Obama years, the Occupy Wall Street. And that's in Twin Peaks. We can't ignore it. We have to, address it as a fundamental part of the story. So I think that really does originate from Frost.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess if I'm trying to think, if there were elements in seasons one or two, it'd probably be the Ben Horn, you know, he's got all the money in the world and he's lording it over everyone. But that still didn't get, and certainly didn't use the phrase 1%. And I feel like that Frost was, and Lynch were actually predecessors on this. They probably were very, very prescient in seeing that phrase was going to become very important over the next few years. And so it became part of the villainy, don't you think, of the return?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Just, you know, you made me think about the original. You mentioned Ben Horn. In a way, it was there, right? The idea that Ben Horn wanted to develop the forest and put in homes, right? He wanted to build it for real estate. And so I think in that era, Ben Horn may have been successful. If he'd been able to, you know, we would have considered it a failure in that he would have destroyed this tract of land and this, you know, beautiful piece of environment. But in terms of monetary success at that time, he would have destroyed some environment and succeeded, made a bunch of money, and developed this land and made it these homes. In this Twin Peaks, that has been done, except it didn't turn out the way Ben Horn would have wanted it to in the original series. These homes were left abandoned, and
Well, it's a prison too, right? So at least in Mark Frost's world, you know, it was developed into a private prison.
Well, yes, it ultimately ends up. That's a little subplot that does exist within the Frost books. It's in, I think, in the Access Guide to Twin Peaks. So from way back in 1991, yeah, I think so. I double checked that.
So it's definitely in the final dossier, because we find out Warden Murphy was the warden of the private prison.
Right. So the Ghostwood development ended up becoming a prison,
which is a great metaphor, isn't it? I mean, that's the story of America.
It is. I wonder if Frost had wanted to maybe address that more in the actual televised version of The Return. We don't have really any evidence to support, you know, for sure that there is a prison there. We do get Audrey make a reference to Ghostwood, which you could read in as being she's imprisoned in a way. But without all that background that we would have to pull from the other texts, we can't, you know, say for sure that that's what it is. But those are, it's interesting. I guess the point is, it's interesting that in some ways, some of those concepts were kind of at play in that original first season of Twin Peaks. And you can see, you know, Frost and Lynch coming back to the material again. And isn't it interesting that one of their original driving mechanisms for the narrative, this development, ends up again being prevalent in the new show, the idea of this economic collapse and you know, this development that happened. It's there in both. And I hadn't really thought about it until right now. So that to me is fascinating.
It seemed to be more playful in the first, more kind of, you know, jocular, and then it became pretty serious. You know, I think there's a strong argument to talk about the difference in control and power between Mr. C and Dougie in the very beginning, part three of that journey, where they're both kind of in the narrative together. And I feel like Dougie is definitely 1% in control of his situation, and Mr. C is like 99% control, and maybe all of the return is just a story about how those ratios change.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that is interesting. Obviously you could really expand on that and make a good argument about that. I'm not sure how deliberate that might have been on the part of Lynch and Frost to tie it into the idea of politics, but as with anything those two folks, you know, put together, the themes are real when we start to see them and we find those echoes of that, those base ideas in other aspects of the story.
Well, I love that, you know, you said earlier, the idea that Lynch has of, you know, politics is part of it, but if you don't rise above it, you know, it's not a story worth telling, essentially, was what I got from your quote from him. And I feel like that's a good example. So we start on this socioeconomic level of 99% versus the 1%. And it is about class. It is about, you know, money. It is about access. It is about privilege. But then you get to the spiritual level of, you know, where is your, how pure is your heart? It seems to be a question that the return asks of us. And right. And so that's a different kind of 99% versus 1%. It raises the level of that conversation.
I agree. And I would say that that's also true of Frost. And again, as I said earlier, obviously Lynch is the last filter. So we always go to Lynch, but I think Frost was obviously interested in expanding, you know, from just, you know, talking about politics and making a commentary on the state of the world, but also, you know, layering in character and layering in the idea of the community and how we treat one another, and those things become, I think, as you say, they transcend just the simple politics. So it's an interesting way to transition in, perhaps into, if you want to, I don't know if you had something else you wanted to, into the Dr. Amp sequences of the return. And obviously, there's no one out there, I think, who would doubt that those are really pure politics. This rage against the way the world is because of forces beyond the control of the everyday human being, the person who is out there trying to live their life in the conditions of the culture and society the way they are. And those people, politicians and perhaps the 1% who own you know, the banking industry and who own the big companies are suppressing and oppressing people. Those are what the things that Dr. Amp is obviously talking about. What strikes me interesting about Dr. Amp is that I don't necessarily see him as the anger that he exhibits as being entirely negative. I think anger in Lynch works and anger in a lot of fiction is a weakness among characters and can lead to negative consequences. With Dr. Amp, I might make the counter argument that the anger, the righteousness of Dr. Amp, is works toward a positive. What do you think about that idea?
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, my favorite kind of anger is self-righteous, moralistic anger. So this is like Jesus overchanging the moneylender's tables in the temple.
Very good. Yeah.
Like that kind of self-righteous rage at something that is just against the laws of nature and man and God is my favorite kind of righteous anger. And there's not 1 second of Dr. Amp in season 3 that I don't love and adore.
He reminds me of, and I've written about this in some writing I'm doing that maybe someday we'll see the light of day, but he reminds me of, I'm going to get the character's name wrong, but I think is it Howard or Harold Beale from the movie Network?
Oh, I've never seen Network. I'm painful to admit, but okay.
Okay. That's fine. No, it's no problem. But there's a famous line, which I'm sure you're going to remember, where he's a newscaster and he's angry at the situation of the world and his, you know, his lot in life and various other factors. And he implores his viewing audience to go to the window and open their windows and yell out into the world, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore."
Okay, so that's what that's from. I've definitely heard that before.
Exactly. And I know you're not familiar with Network, but for me, it seemed that Dr. Amp was doing that. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And he's yelling into the world. And he wants other people to, obviously there is a perhaps selfish side of Dr. Amp, which is worth addressing. We probably should talk about the fact that he is trying to make some money on the side here. He's trying to, he may be a little bit of a snake oil salesman because he's selling this object, which in all likelihood isn't going to do anything for anyone. But then that's worth exploring. But even though he's doing that, the idea that he is that what you talked about, the self-righteous anger and that mad as hell idea, has a power to it, and maybe a transformative power to it.
Yeah, I really love that reading, and the idea of trying to capitalize on you know, right living, right thinking. I mean, that's essentially what religion has become in America anyway. So I think as a kind of a meta statement on just where religion truly lies, I think it's a really nice subversive one.
Yeah, that's interesting too. That the fact that he's selling the gold shovels is that what you're saying? I mean, it's a commentary on...
Yeah, I mean, is there any difference from what gets sold in churches every Sunday in America? That's no different. It's got a real symbol to it, right? Just not a cross, it's a shovel.
Right, right.
It's actually pretty brilliant.
So we should talk a little bit maybe about Dr. Amp's ulterior motives. But before we do, Dr. Amp gets at so many of those core political elements of, and maybe they're concentrated in this, you know, sort of uncut, you know, dose in Dr. Amp and less obvious in other parts of the narrative. But boy, he hits a lot about corporate greed, about the environment, about the poisons in the processed foods that we're consuming, about
the water and the air. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, he's not wrong. At least I guess maybe I'm betraying some of my own political biases here, but I mean, he's really hitting at some important things. And so.
Absolutely. The corruption of politicians, you know, I mean, it basically says, I can't repeat it here, but he says a very uncomfortable sexual act should happen to to politicians who betray the will of the people. And that's like a Dante.
He does in fact say the ninth level of hell will welcome you. That's what he says. And,
oh, that's right. Yeah. Which is a circle for traitors. I mean, I actually looked that up. That's what that circle is.
Oh, did you that's I'm glad you did that. I didn't even think to do that. That's what that ninth circle of hell that Dr. Amp condemns these multinational corporations and the politicians who are supporting them. That that ninth level is for, say, for traders. Traders, is that
what you traders, betrayers of the organism. So another great metaphor for Bob and Mr. C, by the way. So a level of corruption that's so intense that it causes someone's mind to literally betray their body. Very interesting.
Wow, that is interesting. I had not even considered that, but I would say that that was quite deliberate on the part of, I'm going to attribute Frost, I think, more to the Dr. Amp. And I say that because Russ Tamblyn has actually commented on that. And I think there's some YouTube video of him at a festival talking about the Dr. Amp scenes. And he credits Mark Frost for a lot of that dialogue. So I'm sure Frost was quite aware of the ninth level of Dante's Inferno when he wrote that.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's actually one of the more on the nose elements of the return. There's no mistaking Frost's fingerprint on that, in my opinion.
Very interesting. So one thing that Dr. Amp also talks about, and all of this is interconnected, there's no doubt, but he does talk about the environment. He talks about, you know, the toxins and the environmental toxins, our air, our water, our earth, the very soil itself, our food, our bodies poisoned. And then what he does when he sort of overwhelms himself is he takes the huckleberry extract, the clean boiled water. So he's finding a holistic, all natural cure for these chemicals and artificial elements that are artificial additives that are in the environment. But do you see much else in the return that's overtly addressing environmental concerns? I can't find a lot.
Environmental concerns. So the image that I think of.
Yeah, I'm putting you on the spot in the middle of our podcast.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's actually a wonderful question. And it's super important, obviously, today. But the first thing I can think of is the kind of gold oil or whatever we want to call it that exists near Nato's body. I remember thinking about that as like that's a natural substance in an unnatural place. And then you've got, you know, this idea of the black oil on the other side, again, unnatural substance or natural substance in an unnatural place. And I feel like those are metaphors that are worth exploring from an environmental perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The gold versus the black.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's probably it.
It isn't. I mean, you go back to the original show, obviously, and especially late in the second season, they were very obviously addressing environmental issues. It became a main plot, the idea of saving
with the pine weasel,
saving the pine weasel, and then the Miss Twin Peaks pageant itself. I think the theme was the environment, and so they were. I mean, they were obvious about bringing in environmental concerns to the show. I wonder if they, you know, I mean, obviously they couldn't do everything and there was a lot they wanted to address. Maybe they were satisfied with just having Dr. Amp, you know, just get it all out in one long monologue where he talks about the environment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's worth noting that the environment itself is all poisonous to Cooper. Everywhere he goes is a danger to murder him, kill him, you know, mm-hmm. completely remove him. So in some ways that itself is an environmental statement.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because you were talking just a moment ago about poison. And of course we were talking about Amp talking about it as well. And what happens to Mr. C and to Dougie is they vomit up this toxin that is in them. Now, maybe for Mr. C, it's something that empowers him. The cream corn is associated with pain and sorrow from Firewalk with Me, and the idea that this awful substance you put into your body, for us, it would poison us. You see the police react to it when they when they approach his car. And then there's a little bit of reference to it in a toxicology report, I think, that maybe Tammy Preston mentions, or one of the detectives mentions that, and they never follow up on that. I've always thought it would be interesting if they had followed up a little bit more and said, hey, we got the results of this toxicology report.
Yes.
This terrible poisonous substance was inside the car and inside this, what we think is a human being.
In some ways, it was the second nod to X-Files, but you had the Morley cigarettes, you know, that would pass to Chad. And then this idea of a black oil that, you know, that can completely corrupt or poison you. I remember thinking of X-Files when I saw it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, those themes parallel. I should be more prepared on a podcast to think of more environmental, and I'm racking my brain to come up with something else.
Well, I was thinking, what about the frog moth? So that idea of something foreign invading your body and becoming part of you to completely corrupt you, something in the environment, you know, that is a very real danger.
You know, that's fascinating because the frog moth results, you could argue, from the detonation of the first atomic bomb. And if anything was a danger to the environment, it would be radiation.
Yes, sir.
And before that moment, we didn't have radioactive particles, you know, in the air, you know.
Mutations.
Obviously, there's radioactivity in nature, but not like that. This man-made dispersal of radioactive materials across the entire globe, while not overtly addressed as an environmental issue, clearly that moment that happens, that pollution, that what's the word I want to use? That
corruption, yeah.
Contamination.
Contamination.
I mean, it's quite literally the right word. The contamination of the environment happens at that moment, and a contamination that can never be reversed happens the moment that bomb goes off. I hadn't thought about that till now, but
you know, it's interesting to explore. You know, given Mark Frost's comments with Sam Ismail on that podcast a few years ago, where they talked about that scene and Mark referred to it as an originating event, right? Kind of like an origin story, but he never went deeper than that. And I've thought about it for years, and I hope he never does go deeper, by the way, because I like that you can read that in a number of different ways. You know what I mean? It could be an internal reading, an external reading, both at the same time, and it's okay.
Yeah, that it truly is interesting. Well, obviously, I think perhaps in the future we'll talk more about the the nuclear bomb and that whole part eight. But in a way, this is kind of a neat transition to another political topic that is quite deliberate in the return. If you don't mind me transitioning now,
no, let's do it.
And that is war. And the idea of how war affects the citizenry of this country and the world, but particularly the United States. We get a number of war references. We get some important ones in The Return. The first one, I believe, is when the character of Mickey gets in the van with Carl Rod. They're driving into town, and there's a discussion there of a character named Linda, who apparently was injured in the war and requires a wheelchair. And the Veterans Administration is referenced in terms of supplying that wheelchair to her. And there's a bureaucracy involved, and you can see Carl Rod kind of disgusted by the bureaucracy element of it. And, you know, the idea that this person who served in the military and who she, you know, committed herself to the protection of the country, has been injured, and now is really the country owes her. And while it's not explored in a lot of detail, it is there, and it seems to be an important element. Later in that same part, we find out that Frank Truman's son has committed suicide. And from Chad, we get a little bit of background there that, I think Chad's quote is, he couldn't cut it being, or he couldn't take being a soldier. And so, although it's only implied, it's still quite evident that the son of Frank and Doris Truman had been perhaps in combat, who perhaps had PTSD and suffered greatly and committed suicide. Those ideas are there, and they're a driving fundamental part of this world that Twin Peaks: The Return is showing us.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think it's a testament to that concept that Fiona Apple actually. If I don't know if you're a Fiona Apple fan, but she recently released an album that has a song called "Relay" on there, and the chorus is quite brilliant. It says, "Evil is a relay sport when the one you burn turns to pass the torch," and so that idea of this trauma that gets passed down based off circumstance or whatever it may be, that then lashes out to the ones closest, you know, that we should be loving, but instead we abuse, you know, this is Doris to Frank, mm-hmm. you know, she just abuses him the entire time. But when we learn about that trauma, it changes the way we think about her. At least it should, if it's working right on you, don't you agree?
Absolutely. I think it was very cleverly done. When we're first introduced to Doris Truman, she kind of falls into that stereotypical nagging wife character. And, you know, poor Frank Truman, he's been, you know, saddled with this mate. And I'm taking that stereotypical, I'm using that stereotypical approach to describe it, because that's not what it is. And the cleverness of Twin Peaks is that we find out later that she is suffering, that she's behaving the way she is because her son committed suicide, and it was a very difficult thing for her, and she probably had a breakdown because of it. And we also learn more about Frank Truman at that moment, that he is going to care for her, but the source of that was potentially a war. And what kind of war was it for? I hesitate. I don't know if Dr. Jacoby talks about war in his various monologues. I don't think he does, but you could see the idea of perhaps someone going off to fight in a war that may have been something that had some global profit driving mechanism behind it, mm-hmm. a war for oil or something like that. And this young man lost his life because of these circumstances. And as you say, there was a ripple effect. And Doris Truman is a victim.
And she makes Frank a victim. And I think that your point about we get to learn Frank, you know, listen, a lot of viewers were not happy when Michael Onkin didn't come back to reprise his role as Sheriff Truman, right? So, but by the end of The Return, if you gave your heart to it, if you opened your mind to it, and you weren't a Frank Truman fan, realizing that the strength that that man showed, in his stillness and in his calmness, is something that should be emulated. I mean, it's really heroic, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. He is a great character. He really is. He's such a steady, reliable. Yeah.
And so perfectly cast. I mean, Robert Forrester, I honestly could not imagine another person that could have delivered that performance.
And I think he made reference to a scene that was written last minute, the scene where he is on the phone with Harry Truman and talking to him about whatever Harry is suffering. Harry himself is, you know, this may get into another political topic, but Harry is gravely ill, as far as we know. And Frank Truman says, "Beat this thing." And I think that scene was written last minute and given to Robert Forster. And Robert Forster commented about how much he loved doing that scene, that that was one of the highlights of playing that character. He plays it perfectly in that scene. There's a lot of emotion there. And you feel Harry Truman again through the performance, that he's there. So, yeah. it just makes me think, and I don't want to get too far off, but I think, you know, when you talked about Doris Truman and you talked about this, and then we talk about Harry Truman, it reminds me of another very, very small scene that is, there and gone again, but has some political ramifications to it. And that is Beverly Page, the character of Beverly Page, who has this ailing husband at home. And he looks like he's gravely ill. We find out from their conversation, there's a lot going on there about their relationship and about the stresses and the suffering that they're going through. But implied in that is that Beverly Page had to go back to work in order to afford the care for him. And that gets into a healthcare issue. While it is, you know, we just glance at it. We do not spend a lot of time on that issue. It is still incorporated into the narrative. And
I'm actually glad you brought that scene up. I'd like to talk about it for a moment, because just as a vignette, it is, you were immediately drawn into that relationship that she has with Ben. It's very sweet. You want them to work out, you know, when they're flirting with each other and Ben says, I can't do it, and you feel sad. And then when you realize what she's reaching out for to him through this pain that she's running away from at home, it's heartbreaking. And that is probably 6 minutes of screen time. So in 6 minutes, they were able to pierce the veil of, you know, compassion to really evoke something that significantly, time and time again, as I've watched it, has made me truly feel for those characters in that situation.
I agree with you. I think there's a lot going on, and it's well written and it's well performed, and in this concise, you know, short scene, a lot comes through, and you do feel for these two characters, and we don't even really know. The husband really does love, I mean, I forget his name. I think his name is Tom. He really loves Beverly, and she really loves him. But this disease, this ailment that I assume it's cancer.
Yeah, that was my assumption.
It may not be. It parallels maybe what's happening to Harry Truman. But this idea that people get sick and that sickness puts such a stress on the lives of the person who's sick and the people around.
Well, and isn't there an argument that they all live in the same area? And is it possible that there is an environmental corrupting influence that's causing this disease? I don't know. I mean, I think it's not far off.
Obviously, Dr. Amp talks about it. I mean, he does, right? I mean, doesn't he say we're being poisoned by these toxins? So it isn't too far of a stretch to say. I mean, there's nothing that we can point to other than some anecdotal things, to say that this might be it. But because the show is addressing these themes that are important in our lives today, and the very things that are being debated in politics today, healthcare and environment, and the wars or military conflicts, that.
Economic 99%, right? Housing market.
Yeah. Oh, well, of course, the economic issues. They inform, and they connect this Twin Peaks, maybe more so than the original Twin Peaks. They connect this Twin Peaks to our world a little bit more. It is there are references in the original show where we can say, okay, obviously, you know, we share the same background, we share the same world, but not quite as obvious, I think, as it is in this one.
Yeah, I agree. And I keep going back to the statement of Mr. C in part two, I want to say, maybe it's part one, I can't remember off the hand, where they're at the diner and he says, I don't need, I want. And this is a man we later find out is a billionaire. A billionaire with the resources of the planet at his fingertips, and he doesn't need, he just wants. And what does he want?
Power.
Power, but what kind of, I mean, where's the limit of that desire? Is there one?
Yeah, that is an excellent point too. I mean, that is this sort of rampant consumerism, you know, unchecked. And just the idea of totally consuming everything in and leaving just behind you a wasteland.
Yeah.
That is what Mr. C is. That is an excellent point.
And do you think that's political on one level, but it also goes beyond that into the spiritual too, I think.
As we, you know, talked about with the Lynch quote at the very beginning, the idea that those politics connect to perhaps some other larger themes that Lynch and Frost want to explore and address.
So before we move on from war, or if I could just call us back to that just for a moment, I'd like to talk about Carl Rod in respect to that scene that you mentioned with Mickey. I think it's important. So Carl Rod, I think he's a soldier. I look at him as a soldier in The Return, but he fights with a different kind of army, or a different kind of weapon, I should say. Like, he has compassion, and I think that's really interesting.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Carl Rod is positioned as one of the most compassionate people and characters in the whole show. I mean, he cares for other people, and he, you know, he wants to alleviate pain and suffering, pain and sorrow. You see him, right. that's something he's...
Bodhisattva, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, which you could argue was a role that Cooper was inhabiting in the original series. He may be enlightened in a way that the rest of us are not, that he sees that there's a different approach to alleviating pain.
Well, and in Frost's book, I feel like he did a really good job of tying the Log Lady and Carl Rod together into this kind of experience, supernatural experience they had when they were children. If I'm remembering correctly, but it seems like they were abducted by some force or aliens or something, and had an experience that changed them forever. And I feel like they were both kind of elements of that same bodhisattva concept. You know, they witnessed suffering and they tried to do their best to relieve what they saw.
I think that's right. I think those characters are connected. Obviously, they're more connected in Frost's book. But they inhabit that space that very few characters in the story do. You've got Carl Rod. Ironically, that it's Carl Rod now, because you wouldn't necessarily, other than a few interesting lines in Fire Walk With Me where he says, I've already been places. I just want to stay where I am.
Not much compassion there. Back in Fire Walk With Me, right?
Not at the time. Not at the time. Something's happened to him. Carl Rod, the Log Lady, Major Briggs, who can somehow see beyond the world in front of us.
Do you feel like Gordon Cole is also a character like that can see beyond?
I think Gordon Cole is definitely, yeah, I'm not sure Gordon Cole is as savvy as some of those other characters are. I think he's on a path toward that. You can make an argument that he is just as that savvy, but he's masking it. But that gets into a whole different thing. But you know, there's another character, you're going to really be surprised by this, I think.
Okay.
There's another character, and this gets into politics. It just sort of occurred to me now. There was another character who was introduced in the original show for, I think, only one scene in a Lynch-directed, Lynch-scripted episode, who might have been a character we could equate with the Log Lady and Major Briggs. That is a character who might have been in tune with larger forces. And that character was, you're never going to guess, Gersten Hayward. And Gersten Hayward in the original show is this sort of angelic presence who channels the idea of you know, maybe Laura's. I think it's Harriet Hayward who reads the poem, but Gersten plays the piano, and right. There's a sense that she's wearing this sort of fairy outfit, and it resembles the way the Good Witch appears at the end of Wild at Heart, but. She's an interesting character. She's never referenced again, and she just sort of comes in and comes out. And I know it was in some ways a throwaway scene, and I know Lynch, liked. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the actor's name.
Alicia Witt.
Of course, yeah. Worked with her in Dune, and worked again with her in Hotel Room. He wanted to, you know, wanted to find something for her to do in Twin Peaks, so he introduced her. But the characters always struck me as being interesting, and perhaps something more than just what she appears to be. And then we find out in the return, quite shockingly, that Gersten Hayward has taken a terrible turn and is has essentially thrown her life away. Arguably, if she's hanging around with Steven, she probably has. And what were the conditions in her life in the world that would have, we can't necessarily point to, the state or socioeconomic issues, to take the onus off of Gersten and say it was not her fault. She made bad choices, so it was her fault. But
that alone is a political statement, right? It is you have a before and you have an after, and what happened in between is choices and politics.
Well, whatever the world threw at her, she did not have either. I mean, it seems that the character is pretty strong-willed and capable. Granted, she was just a child. And when we see her 25 years later, she's a lost soul. And so there can be a number of reasons, and I know Frost goes into it in the book about the dissolution of the Hayward family as being factors that lead her in this direction. But, obviously the both shows, the original and this show, have this theme of drug use and drug abuse in them, and I think the implication is that Gersten Hayward may very well have become a drug addict.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty clear on the in the episode Mark Frost is in, where he actually comes on him in the tree. And something has obviously happened that was very unfortunate. I think it involved Becky. I think it involved the trailer park. Really close to it, we find out. And Steven's doing a bunch of ranting about some lady in the sky. And I wrote it out in my book. I went through and meticulously caught each word and tried to recapture it. And he says some crazy shit in that scene.
He does. Really crazy stuff. He says some very, very, it's almost impossible to hear. You really got to turn the subtitles on.
I had headphones on. I remember listening to it probably 20, 25 times back and forth just to try and capture.
His speech there and the bizarre comments that he makes resemble some of the comments that Sophie and Abby, I can't remember the names of these Roadhouse booth characters, but when they're talking about going to work and being high,
the zebra,
and then she talks about the zebra and the penguin, which are nonsensical terms. We don't know what to make of them. Are these just the results of minds that are under the influence of drugs, or are they code words for drugs? Or but Steven's crazy rant reminded me a little of that.
Well, didn't it involve a rhinoceros? I feel like he said something about a rhinoceros at some point.
Sure. Well, I'm not quite sure where we were going. We started with Carl Rod and we ended up with Gersten Hayward.
Well, I'd like to pull us back to Mike Nelson. So if we're talking about obscure characters that involve politics, let's talk about Mike Nelson, because I feel like this deserves a small conversation.
Okay, well, what are your thoughts about Mike Nelson?
So the politics of corporate America, that idea of someone like Mike Nelson standing in the way of Steven's choice to try and better himself, to put in some effort. He put a shirt on. He has a high school degree. He showed up. He put his resume in, and Mike Nelson didn't give him a chance. But beyond that, he tore him down to the microscopic level and spit on him to the point where Steven takes a dark turn. And I think that's an often overlooked part of season.
This is really interesting, because this really does get into politics, because you are interpreting that in a way that I had not. And I don't know if it's just an ideological approach that you and I came at from different ways. I'm fascinated with what you just said, and I think it's completely valid. I hadn't thought of it that way. I thought of it as Mike Nelson could see through Stephen and see that what a loser Stephen was, and that
that's not untrue.
Right. And that he was just disgusted by this poor effort that Stephen had done on the resume. And so he dressed him down and basically said, you know, he gave him some hard life Dr. Amp type lessons, you know, go out, don't ever do this again, you know. And that's how I looked at that scene. But I think you were right. You could look at it, the idea that if Mike Nelson had been a little more sympathetic towards Stephen, maybe it would have taken a different turn. I never thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, think of the difference. And basically he told him to go kill himself. I mean, that was the tone, that was the delivery, that was the message. He didn't quite go that far, but it was right on the cusp of, you are completely worthless and you don't have a reason to exist. So, you know, good luck. And it had the same effect on Stephen. You know, it may have taken a few more days to work its magic on him, but I think that statement basically killed that character.
You have opened my eyes to that scene in a way I had never considered before. And I had to think about it. I mean, it's hard for me to shake the impression I already have of that, is that Mike Nelson was, I guess the way I read it was that Mike Nelson was seeing his younger self. And was disgusted by what he used to be, which was essentially this sort of loser drug. I mean, I don't, Mike Nelson wasn't that, never quite as bad as Bobby was supposed to be, but he was involved in this side of things. He was obviously involved in some of the drug dealing that was going on when, you know, obviously he goes with Bobby to meet Leo in the woods. So, you know, Mike had a pretty seedy side to him. And so he was kind of a juvenile delinquent. And I guess I saw it as Mike, now in middle age, stuck behind a desk in perhaps a job that really wasn't going to ever progress beyond where it was now, looking at this younger self coming in and saying, you know, speaking to himself and not to Stephen, saying, you know, what a loser you are. And he's angry at himself. That's kind of the way I read that. And I think both yours and mine are completely and equally valid.
Yeah, I think they can be right at the same time. But this idea of passing the torch, like, you know, evil is a relay sport. He turned and he burned someone else.
Interesting.
And it's a political act. It has ramifications. Like, now imagine a Mike Nelson who had learned to do transcendental meditation and who practiced Buddhism and ate right and took care of himself and really looked at his job as providing a civic duty. And this young man comes in who's very troubled. And instead, Mike Nelson says, listen, buddy, I hate to tell you, but I don't think you're qualified for this job. What I have done is laid out four things that you can do starting tomorrow that are going to improve your chances of getting to where I'm sitting right now so that I can get to the next desk, because that's my goal. What's your goal? Like, imagine that conversation.
Okay, that ties back to Carl Rod, because Carl Rod might have done something like that. Carl Rod sees Criscoll giving his blood and doesn't want Criscoll to do that. Carl Rod sees the woman in the intersection, and all he can do, he has to do something. He can't just stand around like the other people are doing. He goes over and he kneels with her and he shares her pain. So Mike does not behave in any kind of sympathetic way. That's a very, very interesting observation there. Could he have done something to steer Stephen on a different path? I had never thought about it.
Sure. Yeah. It's just words, right? I mean, they're just words. They're cheap. But I like this idea because it opens us up to the larger conversation of these characters that are influenced by energies. You know, that concept of Twin Peaks, of the black fire versus the white fire or the pure fire, and the idea of, it's, you know, Hawk's statement about it's the energy and the intention behind it. Like, that's the difference. It's the action and not necessarily the act itself. It's the intent behind the act that is, it can be come political, but it can also go past politics into something spiritual and something moral and more than just the political.
I agree. And I think a great example of that is Dr. Amp again. We'll go back to Dr. Amp, who is obviously this, you know, major political figure in that he is espousing a political ideology with perhaps his own ulterior motives, a lot of anger. But it's certainly arguable that he has a positive effect on Nadine. And he makes Nadine better. Nadine then makes perhaps, you know, frees Ed to go to Norma, and then Norma and Ed are back together again. So it's a chain reaction, what you're talking about, right? The idea of passing it along.
It's also a relay, right? It's also a passing of the torch. It's just a kinder one. Or you're passing a torch of kindness.
And I have thought about that because what's fascinating about that sequence, so Dr. Amp to Nadine to Ed to Norma, and Ed and Norma's reunion in the Double R, we see Shelley in the Double R watching this happen. This is Shelley's last scene in the entire 18 hours. We don't see her again after this moment. And Shelley, we have seen, has made some bad choices. But there's hope in that moment, I think, that when Shelley sees what's happening between Ed and Norma, that same thing that's passing along, as you're talking about, passes to Shelley. And that there's hope there that she could reunite with Bobby. There's obviously they are still compatible, and they are still, you know, obviously on speaking terms and are in each other's lives to some extent.
Yeah, they're almost functional parents, right?
Yeah. And so I always think of it that way, in a hopeful way, that Shelley may end up in a happier place because of what you're talking about, that whole idea of...
Well, and I think, you know, so we look at that, where that scene is in The Return, like, and what happens in that episode, that is the breakthrough that, you know, we talked about this on a previous episode, I'm sure, where the log lady was talking about it all comes rushing mm-hmm. through now. Like, that breakthrough of kindness and forgiveness and empathy that Nadine has for her husband mm-hmm. or ex-husband or whatever their situation is right then. And then when she releases him, that act of forgiveness, it changes everything about the return. And I argue that that is the point that Mr. C starts to lose.
Excellent. Good way of thinking about it. Forgive me for going back to something small, because that's a large concept. But we talked about this in a previous phone call. It wasn't a podcast. When Nadine is changed by Dr. Amp, but Dr. Amp, let's say Jacoby now, because Jacoby is driving down the street at night and he sees the gold shovel in the in the window, and he stops short and he goes in and he can find out what's going on here. That takes him by surprise, and I think. And I think that he is somewhat amazed that his words have had an impact on someone, maybe helped them. And in that moment, perhaps he himself is helped. Do you see that same thing?
I do. And I guess let me ask you a personal question, because you've written a lot about Twin Peaks over the past 25, 30 years. Have you met someone who's thanked you for the stuff you wrote and Wrapped in Plastic and told you how much it meant to them in the 90s and, you know, and in the 2000s?
I have, actually. Many times people have said that to me. It is one of the nicest things I ever hear, is somebody comes up and Mm-hmm.
So that's it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it amazing, John, to think that your words have mattered to someone that much? So that's Dr. Amp.
Yeah. Right? Well, first of all, you're making me think of the times that it's happened. And I must say, it is perhaps the most rewarding thing that's ever happened, is when people thank you for something that you did. You know, you realize, oh, wow, I made a difference maybe a little bit.
Well, I remember seeing this live with Cheryl Lee. So I was privileged to meet her and Ray Wise last year here in Columbus. And there was a line of people that wanted to meet her, obviously, and get stuff signed. And I was lucky to kind of go first, because I knew the guy who was running it. So I kind of slipped in there. But that gave me the privilege of being able to watch her interact with these fans that just came up and poured their heart out to her, and she accepted it. But that notion that the things we do and the words we say and the art that we create can have that kind of a ripple effect on the world around us, it's an alien feeling, I think, you know, to realize that we can have an impact on people by doing nothing. or little to nothing, right?
And I will say as a footnote here, since you brought that topic up, just something about Cheryl Lee. She has embraced that character, a very difficult character, I'm sure, to play. She has embraced that character. She respects that character of Laura Palmer and understands the impact that it had on other people. And I have watched her too meet people who are crying and talk to them. And she has taken on this role, which I don't think she was looking for, but it came her way. And she understands how important and what it means to people. If you watch the interview that she did that's on, I think it's on this new box set that came out, and Kyle MacLachlan, she performs extremely well in that interview. She understands that character better than the interviewer does, by far.
Well, that question, just on that note, and I felt this watching that the interviewer, and I think it's Christine McKenna, isn't that the lady who wrote The Room to Dream? So the question she asked her was essentially that Laura, you know, something along the line of Laura's sex is at the root of all of her issues or something. It was a very interesting way to phrase the question. I'll leave it at that. Cheryl's response to that was just devastating and so true.
She rejects the premise of the question totally and says that is not it. And we can talk about that issue. It's valuable to talk about, but the idea that Cheryl Lee is so aware of that character and who that character is and what that character means to people. I know we're going way off on a tangent here, but it's really important.
We can bring that back to war. That's a war, right? I mean, that's a war, and art is a solution for it.
I guess the bottom line is how much I admire Cheryl Lee and what she's done, and how she's taken on this, the burden of this character to some extent, and embraced it. And so I admire her greatly for the way she has performed over the years. It's just really fantastic.
Agreed.
Well, we've really gone all over the place.
it wouldn't be a podcast of ours if we didn't roam the territory.
There are probably other topics we could touch upon, but I'm wondering if maybe we've hit the main points we wanted. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we have. I guess the only last point is that, you know, everyone in The Return is suffering. There's not a character that gets out alive without suffering in this show. And that is a political statement in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's Janie E right there, I think. Janie E says, it's one of the more critical lines, I think, in the entire thing. We live in a dark, dark age. And then she says something about, I wish I had the line in front of me. It's worth looking up. She says, this is how do we treat people? She's talking about, you know, the need to treat people well when she's confronting these two loan sharks, essentially, or these two, you know, guys who are trying to collect on the money that Dougie owes.
What a great scene.
It is a great scene. It's almost like a throwaway scene. And Janie E is sometimes portrayed as somewhat of a stereotypical character, but I don't see that after watching it a number of times. She kind of gets right at the core of things here. And she talks about suffering in a way. She talks about the dark age, and she talks about treating how you treat people. And that is just one of the most fundamental concepts that's woven throughout the 18 hours, is the suffering of people, and how you treat people who are suffering, and how you deal with your own suffering, all of that.
Yeah, and that's a war. You know, I think that's a war in and of itself. I like the idea that the characters who, quote, make it out, you know, I don't know if we talked about reincarnation when you mentioned that Shelley, you think that's the last time she's seen, and you think that might be some kind of release. Maybe those characters are kind of released from karma and they're not reincarnated anymore, whatever you want to place on that. That idea of you have to go all the way through suffering and past it in order to end up in the space that Janie E does in the end, where she is a completely changed person, and she is happy, and she is balanced, and she has the things in her life that, you know, don't, that money won't buy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Certainly, I think Ed is a great example of that too. All that Ed has been through, and he, in that last moment where he thinks that everything that he has gone through in his life may have been for naught, in that moment where he thinks he's lost Norma.
The cyanide pill moment, right?
He turns and he meditates for a moment. And he trusts in himself and he trusts in the universe. And we can get all metaphysical if you want. But I mean, it's a powerful scene and it really is moving and it's very effective. There's something about Ed there. There's something about Ed's trust in something good. And then her hand comes onto his shoulder. It's just a marvelous scene. It's a fantastic scene.
Makes me cry every time I watch it, if I'm being honest. And I think it's probably one of the best advertisements for transcendental meditation I've ever seen.
Well, there you go. There you go. I mean, look, Ed had faith in himself, right? He really did. And it paid off. Obviously, there are, I'm looking at my notes, there's more topics we could get to in terms of how Twin Peaks addresses some political issues.
How about one last one? The presidents okay. That show up in The Return. I was fascinated.
Oh, I was going to pick another one.
Well, let's do two.
Well, but the presidents, you know, our president, that's interesting. We can do that. I mean, the idea that we see these presidents show up again and again. We see Lincoln. We see Eisenhower show up in a picture that Johnny Horn bashes his head into. And then we see that same Eisenhower picture in the Las Vegas FBI offices. We have a fascinating scene where Gordon Cole laments that he's not going to be able to see Mount Rushmore, and Albert brings a picture of the four presidents, and Cole comments on it.
Faces of stone. Yeah.
I don't know what necessarily the political meaning that has there, but clearly there's references over and over again to presidents of the United States and a presence of some sort in the story. I don't know how much I want to read into that.
We just let that one sit, and if a reader has an opinion on it or a listener, please let us know.
The one other political thing, I wasn't going to get into it, but we will, is gun control and mass shootings. There is no mass shooting necessarily in Twin Peaks, but there is obviously an incident with a gun where a young boy shoots a gun that his father has put in the car and the mother inadvertently put in the back seat, and is a loaded pistol. I'm not sure how much obviously it's a commentary on the idea of gun control and random gunfire in a public space. It's there. And the fascinating thing about that kid, when he steps out of the car, Bobby's looking at him. The kid is dressed exactly like his father is. They both have the camo jacket, the blue jeans, the camo cap. Bobby notices it. He sees the parallel there. And the idea there may be that that's a reflection in some ways of Bobby's own psyche, is that our bad behaviors are passed on to our kids. That is less a political statement and perhaps more about human nature. But the political element there is the gun and the bullet flying into the Double R Diner and this.
And why is this idiot driving around with a loaded weapon rattling around in the floorboard of his car where his kid could get a hold of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Obviously not someone who seems to care about the safety of his family or the safety of others.
Yeah, in some ways, the gun is kind of an anti a symbol from the golden shovel. it's not a way to dig yourself out. It's quite the opposite, right? In Twin Peaks, at least.
Mm. Yeah, it's a powerful object. There are lots of powerful objects in Twin Peaks that are supernatural. But this gun is a real-world powerful object that, in the wrong hands... And I'm not making a statement on guns and the right to bear arms and all of that. That's for another conversation, perhaps. The fact of the matter is, though, that it is a dangerous and powerful object that can obviously cause great harm and damage and trauma and all of what we've talked about. And it almost does. And I think that is clearly a commentary on the political and one of the most fraught political issues of our times. Our guns in the public space.
Agreed. I think the image of Ike the Spike getting his hand burnt by the gun, you know, that Cooper, when Cooper grabs him, it basically causes his hand, that gun in his hand, to become, you know, poisonous, toxic to his skin, or, you know, something like, along those lines. But it's powerful enough. Listen, I've seen people fire guns before. I've never seen anyone peel the skin of their palm off from firing guns. So something supernatural or unnatural happened there, right?
I think so. Anyway, I think I'll leave the gun thing at that and not go.
Well, it's rooted to the show. Like everything we just discussed, you can go watch that for yourself. You can interpret it your own way. But I think you and I are on the same page with that. I don't think that firearms are portrayed as positive in Twin Peaks: The Return. It's just my assessment.
I mean, I think Mark Frost would be, I don't want to put more words in Mark Frost's mouth, but I think, you know, he would say, hey, you know, you've got these powerful objects, treat them with care. If you're going to have them, treat them with care and treat them as the powerful objects they are. Yeah. Let's not be so cavalier.
That's a great statement. I think, and I think anyone would agree with that. That's sensible. Don't you think, on whatever side of the issue you're on?
I think that's a sensible.
Yep.
But you know, but.
But we'll leave it at that.
Politics was a driving force for the creation of this new Twin Peaks. It is something to keep in mind, although it's not an overt thing. And I think Lynch, as we said in his quote, was certainly not going to allow politics to dominate. We can't forget that the conditions of the world were in the forefront of Mark Frost's mind when he wanted to come back to Twin Peaks.